We're going to stay on sort of the theme that we were discussing with groundwater, which is water that moves through certain rock types. And remember I mentioned that, sand, gravel, acts as a good reservoir for groundwater. In other words, there's pore space there, and there's also potentially permeability. We talked about that a bit. We're going to continue on those materials, so talking about sand and gravel, which is generally referred to as aggregate, okay, when you're talking about an industrial mineral. So let's go there. Let's start on that piece. So these are industrial construction minerals, materials. Not all of these things are minerals that are listed here. Like clay is not a mineral. I mean, there are a lot of different minerals that are considered clay minerals, like kaolinite, which we mentioned. Smectite would be a mineral, right? Those all fall under clay. And again, clay is just a really fine-grained sedimentary, either sediment or sedimentary rock. Dimension stone. Okay, this is the type of stuff that you would be buying if you were, remodeling your kitchen or something and putting in countertops, right? And you want a stone countertop. That would be dimension stone. You'd go to the countertop place and look at all the different rocks they have, and you would you'd buy some rock. Well, that rock comes from somewhere. It's actually mined from somewhere, right? And then it's shipped to the countertop place or whatnot, and you can buy it. That would be dimension stone, right? And there's famous quarries out there where this stuff comes from, whether it's in Italy or elsewhere. A lot of it comes from South America, actually. But yeah, dimension stone is a piece of it. Gypsum, we mentioned. Okay, slag, crushed stone, sand, gravel, cement. So we are going to be talking about some of these in more detail, including cement. But here I'm going to focus on crushed stone, sand, and gravel. So these are industrial and construction. I should probably say materials here because not all of these things are minerals. But yeah, there is quite a market, for this stuff, right? Whether it's in construction or in industrial uses. So one of the things that we did look at already, we already saw this slide, gypsum. This is just showing naturally occurring gypsum in a lake deposit. So you have these different layers of rock here, right? So this would be mudstone. It could be clay, some sort of a fine grain sediment. And then you have these layers of gypsum, which is, as it says here, an evaporite, right? And so this gypsum is suggesting that the environment at the time that this was deposited was relatively dry, right? Because you had these lake deposits and the lakes are evaporating out, concentrating those dissolved solids so that they precipitate out as salts. And in this case, gypsum is a type of salt. Again, gypsum is being used in the industrial sense in construction quite a bit. Like you think of drywall, which goes on the outside of your wood framing, right? That, or for the inside of the house. Right, that is, gypsum is a very big part of that material, but it's used for all sorts of things. Okay, so we talked about gypsum, but we are going to talk about sand and gravel here. So this graph is showing, change in price since 1960. So some of these things have become more valuable, and that could be because of the demand side. It could be because of the supply side. Either demand goes up or supply goes down. Ultimately, that's what determines these curves, right? And so gypsum is down here, which we were just talking about. It's pretty flat. Demand exists, has increased through construction, but supply has been able to keep up with it. You have cement shown here by this dotted line. Okay, the price has gone up of that a bit. Dimension stone is this one, which I just mentioned, this kind of gray curve. Check out sand and gravel. Well, clays, first of all, we already talked a little bit about clays. Clays have so many different uses, though, so that's a pretty complicated one. But sand and gravel is this sort of darker, this black curve, and look, it really spikes here up going towards 2010. Okay, so increased demand and or decreased supply. Sand and gravel, you don't really think of that as being all that fancy, right? It's not like copper or gold or something, but it is very useful, and it has all sorts of applications. Okay, we're going to talk about that a little bit. So when we talk about sand and gravel, well, what sort of natural deposits are we looking at? This is the same type of depositional environment, if you will, for the sediment that is forming our reservoir rocks, which once buried become aquifers in places that store fluid that we care about, whether it's water or oil and gas, right? But in this case, this is just showing sort of the natural environment where that sediment is first deposited. So there's a lot of different types of environments. The delta here, which is kind of in the middle. Deltas are the most prolific location on Earth in terms of sediment and gravel deposition. Okay. Sand and gravel deposition, also a lot of mud, so clays. But you get tons of sand and gravel being deposited in deltas more than any other location in the world, right? So in the Willamette Valley, we have a river that runs through the Willamette River, clearly, and there is deposition of sand and gravel in the valley, right? There's some amount that's being deposited, and it's actually being mined. It's being quarried. Okay, we'll talk about that. But a lot of that material that the Willamette River is transporting downstream, right, is heading towards the ocean ultimately. And it goes out, it meets up with the Columbia River up north of Portland, and then that water continues downstream down the Columbia to the Columbia River Delta, which is where the Columbia River hits the ocean. And there is, that is where the majority of sediment is being deposited. Okay, so you have all this sediment. Where's it coming from? It's coming from the surrounding mountains, right? It's coming from the Cascades. It's coming from the Coast Range, all the watersheds that feed the Willamette River. You have rock up there that's being exposed, okay, at higher elevations, and it gets hammered by precipitation. It gets hammered by snow. You know, it goes through freeze-thaw cycles that break the rock up, and ultimately water starts moving that material downstream. And as it goes downstream, those particles get smaller and smaller. They go from being boulders or larger cobbles, etc., to breaking down, getting smaller and smaller into sand size, eventually mud size, right? And then they make their way all the way out to the ocean, and they're deposited in this delta. The reason why so much of this material is deposited in deltas is because, number one, there's two things really. Number one, you have room for it. When you come into the ocean, all of a sudden there's all this space to put sediment, right? If you think about the Willamette Valley, you know, sediment and water always wants to go downhill, right? It wants to travel downstream, which is downhill towards a topographic low. And if you don't have a basin, right, if you don't have a low, a topographic low, for the water to go and for that sediment to fill up, then the sediment's going to bypass wherever you're at and just continue downstream until you hit the ocean. The ocean is kind of the ultimate low, right? You don't get any lower than that. And so that's where the sediment eventually makes its way to. And you have plenty of space out there to put sediment. We aren't going to fill up the ocean, right, with sediment, but there's space so the sediment can go there. The other reason why you get it deposited in a delta specifically, as opposed to somewhere else in the ocean, out in the middle of the ocean or whatnot, is because if you imagine yourself being like a sand grain, okay, and you're traveling along in the river, right, the river has some velocity associated with it. And that's going to be related to both the amount of water that's traveling through it and the size of the channel, okay? If you have a very large channel, actually, you can move more slowly. If you have a small channel and you try to put a lot of water through that, you're going to have to move quickly. So the size of the channel actually matters as well. But regardless, that water is moving at a certain velocity. And in order for sand grains, cobbles, whatever type of sediment we're talking about, in order for that to be transported, there has to be a certain amount of kinetic energy. So velocity, right, speed of water in order to keep that sediment in suspension. Because the sediment has some weight to it, right? It takes energy actually to move that sediment. So if the river isn't flowing very quickly, it may not have enough energy, kinetic energy, to actually transport sediment very much. But these rivers do. So they're transporting sediment downstream, the Columbia River, tons of water, right? That's got a lot of kinetic energy. Okay, so it's transporting the sand downstream. Eventually it makes it to the ocean. What happens when that water hits the ocean? Well, it slows down. It slows down significantly, right? It hits this huge body of water and all of a sudden it just kind of stops. You know, and it starts moving along with ocean current, sure, but that flow, that kinetic energy that exists in the river decreases once it hits the ocean. And so because of that, the sediment no longer stays in suspension and it falls out of suspension and deposits. And that's why deltas again end up being such a huge pile of sediments in the world, because there's space for the sediment and because sort of the world changed, right, from the sediment's perspective. As soon as it hits that delta, all of a sudden the speed of the water slows way down. It's in this big open ocean. We say the degree of confinement has decreased, right? You go from this confined channel, which means you have high velocity flow, to coming into the ocean, which is just completely unconfined. So now it's just this huge body of water, and so it deposits out. So you can, in this image, you can see we can get river and stream bar deposits. Okay, and that happens in the river system. We have that in the Willamette as well. But most of that sediment, the huge big piles are going to be out in the delta. The sand spit is really, you know, it's part of a delta system ultimately. It's just the sediment from the delta that's being reorganized and distributed through ocean currents. So longshore currents are the currents that go along the beach, along the coastline, sort of parallel to the coastline, and they'll take some of that delta sedimentation and they'll push it out to the sides. Okay, I'm actually going to, because it's kind of interesting, I want to pull us over to quickly, let's go into Google Maps for a second. So this is, you know, the Portland area. It's just kind of cool to be able to do this. I mean, you couldn't do this, what, 15 years ago because we didn't have all this cool imagery. But, okay, so we're in the Portland area, right? And this here is the Willamette Valley. Okay, I'm actually going to go to terrain for a second. That might make it pop out a little bit better. There you go. So we have the Cascade Mountains here. We get the Coast Range over here. All right, let me move this a little. Coast Range here, the Willamette Valley, Salem, Eugene, etc. Right, notice the valley is relatively flat, okay, and then the mountains have topography. So whenever you have a flat surface on the earth, you're probably dealing with a basin, just FYI. You're probably dealing with a place where you have sediments being deposited. So that gives you a sense of what rocks should exist under your feet. They're going to be sedimentary rocks in these sort of flat areas where you have basin sediments. While you come up into the mountains, they could also be sedimentary rocks up there, but you now have the possibility of finding all sorts of other types of rocks. And in this case, like in the Cascades, for example, we're talking about volcanic rocks. But regardless, so we have all these rivers that are coming out of the mountains, right? So they're eroding these mountains, as I mentioned, and the sediment is coming downstream, you know, whether you're from over here, past Mill City, this would be the Saniam River. You know, the Clackamas River is right up here. It's coming through, and it's transporting sediment. Eventually, these tributaries to the Willamette River, which you can see here, right? This is the Willamette. These things dump into the Willamette, and the Willamette continues transporting sediments downstream past the city of Portland, eventually hits the Columbia River, which is a much larger river because it's got a huge watershed that extends all the way up into Canada. And that sediment continues downstream. Well, some of the sediment's deposited in the Willamette Valley. Okay, and how is that deposited? Well, we're going to look at this in a bit, but you have, you know, these meanders in the river, right? And generally on the inside of these meander bends, okay, this would be the point bar is what these things are called, the inside of meander bends. So this part here or this part here, right? These end up being depositional environments. So this is where you get sediment being deposited. We'll talk about why in just a little bit. And then on the outside of these meander bends is where you have generally erosion occurring. So on the inside is deposition, on the outside is erosion. So on the inside where you have deposition, that's where you're like literally your sand and gravel is being deposited. Okay, so that's one place you could go. You go to just a river system, find the meander bends, find the point bars, which are these things, and you could just use those as your quarries for sand and gravel, right? There's a lot that's being deposited there. On the other hand, if we continue down the Columbia River, a lot of the sediment, as I mentioned, is continuing out here in this direction and eventually making its way out to the ocean, right? And then we have, interestingly, we have these, as I was just looking in the image, right? We have this bar here. It's, you know, an island, well, not an island, but there you go, Long Beach. I was trying to remember the name of this. But this is the geologic term for this. You know, there's a lot of things you can call these things, but I call them a strand plane. Okay, and a strand plane is a type of delta, ultimately, where you have water that's moving all this sediment into this area. We're going to go back to satellite view here. Okay, so a bunch of sediment's coming out here and being deposited in the delta, the Columbia River Delta, right? And some of that is being redistributed, as I saw in the previous image there, it's being distributed to the north, up through Long Beach. That's what creates this strand plane right here, okay? This strand plane is being created by longshore currents. And then you also have one to the south. This is also a strand plane, okay? And it's just sediment from the delta that's being transported south and north. Why is it being transported in both directions? Well, that's because the currents in the Pacific Northwest actually can change Through the seasons, right? Depending on the dominant wind direction, which does tend to change from winter to summer. And so you get a little bit that's being transported northward, then other times of the year you get some that's being transported southward. But it looks like most of it's being transported northward, which doesn't surprise me because southwesterly, so air that's coming from the southwest, that is going to be the dominant air direction during winter, okay? During winter storms, etc., which tend to be the kind of the most significant wind events in the Pacific Northwest. So it's southwesterly, it's coming from the southwest, which is pushing sediment to the north. Okay. So this anyway would be an amazing place, right? It's tons of sand. It's really well sorted. An amazing place to go and quarry sand if you needed it for industrial uses or otherwise. I just wanted to show that in the image. Let's go ahead and head back to the slide deck here. So yeah, we were just looking at, Long Beach is ultimately a sand spit, as is shown here. I call it a strand plain. It's a little bit more of a fancy geologic term. But yeah, so that's the delta, right? So that's a good place. And then again, we also mentioned that we have these river systems with meanders, etc. Okay, you can also go up even closer to the mountains here and find alluvial fans, and then glacial deposits. We actually have some of those. If I could show you some of those moraines. We do have glacial moraines on Mount Hood. I mean, these things are not being quarried, but that is a location where you get sediment. And then, yeah, alluvial fans. I'm just going to show a quick, why not, a quick image of that as well. So we're back on the map here. Here's Mount St. Helens. Let's go down to Mount Hood. Okay, and the Mount Hood's interesting. We do have glaciers on Mount Hood. They're primarily on the north side, and that's because they get less direct sun, and so they tend to persist more. But if you come up here, right, and up to sort of Cooper Spur, there's actually a road that comes up here. You can see this guy. You can drive all the way up to Cloud Cap. Okay, and there's a little campground over there. But yeah, you can drive up to Cloud Cap, and from here you can do some hikes. You can take a look at Elliott Glacier, right, which is ultimately this guy, okay, ELIOT, Elliott Glacier, coming down off the north, kind of northeast side of Mount Hood. And what it has is on the sides, it's kind of hard to see in this image. Maybe if I go to terrain view, we'll be able to see the elevation here. Yeah, there you go. So you have the glacier itself, which is, snow. It's probably covered with dust or sediment to some degree. But you come down, you can see you have these edges to it. These are the moraines, okay? And these consist of poorly consolidated, also very poorly sorted, which just means that you have a lot of different grain sizes. You can have silt-sized grains, sand-sized grains, cobbles, stuff that's larger as well, all just mixed up in a jumble. And these are piles of relatively unconsolidated sediment on the sides here. And so as the glacier's coming down, it acts like a bulldozer, right? It's pushing that material. And oftentimes you'll end up with an end moraine as well, one at the tip, which I don't see an obvious one in this case, at least coming out in this image here. Okay. But so, yeah, that would be the glacial material. So those do have potential in terms of, quarrying and such. We are not doing that on Mount Hood. The other thing that was mentioned here, which I'm just going to, just because it was in that image, I want to talk about just for a second, are alluvial fans. Do you remember that image I showed there? Okay, let's go down to Death Valley, which is way down here in California. So if you see where I'm at, this is California, Nevada, etc. Death Valley National Park. I don't know how many people in this class have had a chance to go there. But let's go back into satellite view now. Okay, so Death Valley National Park, right? Real beautiful area. I went to college in Los Angeles, and so and I was studying geology, so I had a chance to go out there quite a bit and look at things. But this is just a really good place to see alluvial fans. So, we have a valley here. This is Death Valley, literally. You got this range here, including Telescope Peak, which is very high. There's a small image of it sort of popping up above the valley here. So we have a lot of erosion that's occurring. All the sediment's coming down, and then it's being deposited down here in the valley. And it's creating these aprons of sediment, right, coming out of these canyons. Okay, these are alluvial fans. Okay, that's what it's referring to. And so there's just tons and tons of unconsolidated sediment in these things. These could also be quarried. That's sort of the point there. It's another location where you get this stuff being concentrated. And there's a really beautiful one here somewhere. Let's see if I can find it. Well, that one's not too bad. I'm getting a little too far north here. Yeah, me. There's a lot here. That so on the left side, you can see this whole apron of alluvial fans. If you combine them together into just one long feature like this, is called a bajada, which is B-A-J-A-D-A, kind of an interesting term. So a bunch of alluvial fans that coalesce together along a range front like this is referred to as a bajada. On the other side of the range, you can see, or on the other side of the valley, I should say, you can see here's an alluvial fan. It looks really beautiful. It's a semicircle, right? So you have all this sediment that's coming out of the mountain here. And as soon as it gets into the valley floor, it's no longer confined. So it just sort of spreads out in this apron or semicircle. This is a single alluvial fan, okay? Coming out of this canyon is sort of really nice and easy to see. You can see these things. You can see quite a few of them. On this side of the valley, there's a smaller one there that's kind of a different color, right? So the source of these sediments coming out of this canyon, it's sourcing a little bit of a different rock type than these guys, which is also kind of fascinating. You can see these things in the desert. The desert's a great place to do geology because you can actually see the rocks, right? As opposed to in the forested Pacific Northwest, the west side of the Cascades, which is beautiful, of course, but real hard to do geology because you can't see any of the rocks. They're covered with vegetation. So it's hard to know what's actually underneath you. And in the desert, you can see them all. So it's a good place to study it. But yeah, you can see many alluvial fans here. So that's what we're referring to in that previous image. Well, let's go back to it now. Here, the alluvial fans, right? And when those things combine up, you end up with a bajada. Okay. So we looked at pretty much all parts of this image now. So lots of places you can get sediment. But again, the most significant out there, it's going to be your delta in terms of just sheer amounts. Okay, so let's continue. And hey, speaking of that, actually, this is a really fascinating image to me. This is showing global sediment thickness throughout the world. Okay, and how do we even know this? And this is in kilometers, 0 to 22 kilometers. So think about it. We're talking about, you know, at the maximum here where you get real red, we're talking over 10 kilometers of sediment in terms of thickness. That's a huge pile of sediment, 10 kilometers thick. Right, well, how do we accumulate that much sediment in one place, right? That's the rivers and deltas and things that are depositing this material. Well, notice where these are in the world. So these really red spots. This is also, I should note that this image, how do we even know this, right? How do we get this information? This comes from gravity. This is a gravity map, okay? This image comes from gravity information. And I mentioned earlier, you know, how do we know about the structure of the Earth, etc.? Part of the way that we know is through potential fields data. That's a fancy term, which just involves, you know, remote sensing of these forces, you know, the ultimately force of gravity. There's some other potential fields that exist out there too, but gravity being one of them. And it's seeing how is the force of gravity changing so slightly as you move across the surface of the Earth. That's exactly what this is showing here. So as you go, like the Gulf of Mexico, which is this area in red, right? Real thick pile of sediments. One of the thickest piles in the world. I mentioned this previously. Why is it so thick? Well, there's a couple of reasons. You have a sediment supply that's coming through the Mississippi River, right? The you know, Mississippi Delta, where it is today. And you have other deltas that come into the Gulf of Mexico too. But the Mississippi is draining a huge watershed throughout North America. Right, and that has been happening for a very long time. That's the key. In order to get a real thick pile of sediments, you need millions and millions of years to do that. And we have, you know, 50 plus million year old sediments at the base, at the lower parts of this basin. So this has been depositing sediments in this location for 50 million years. Okay, so we have a very, you know, stable watershed in a sense. It's the continental interior of the United States, which is tectonically stable. In other words, it's not over long, long geologic timescales, it's staying relatively the same, okay? And that's because it's not like we are in Oregon. We're on the edge of plates, right? We're the North American plate and the Pacific plate. We're at the intersection, but where those two plates are coming together, okay? It's a convergent margin where those plates are coming together. We've got a subduction zone, right? And so there's all sorts of stuff that's going on in that margin that's just really, that's disruptive to any sediments that the Columbia River is deposited in the delta. You know, a lot of those sediments are getting subducted underneath the North American continent. So, you know, they're being recycled into the earth. In this case here, this is a very stable basin. It's called a passive margin. So there's no active tectonics going on there. There's no plates running into each other or anything like that. It's just a stable location. Okay. No, you know, significant earthquakes are going to be existing, et cetera. There's no volcanoes there. Okay, it's a stable location. So, you know, sediments being deposited over a very long period of time, stable location. It is the ocean though. So you got plenty of space for the sediments. And so you get this real thick pile, you know, over 13 kilometers of sediment in the Gulf of Mexico. And what are these sediments? How are they being deposited? They're delta sediments, right? As I mentioned, deltas are going to be depositing most of your sediments. And if you go along the edges of the continents, that's where you get your sedimentary packages, especially along what we call passive margins, which is like the east coast of the U.S. is a passive margin too. Not tectonically active, right? That you don't have a plate here that's subducting underneath a plate here, for example, or plates coming together. There's no activity, okay, across that boundary. There's no tectonic activity across that boundary. So it's stable. It's called a passive margin. And so the sediments that are deposited there, they can just sort of sit and chill and they aren't being disturbed. Okay, and these are being deposited by deltas also. You go all around the world, same thing. This part of Brazil, right? Brazil, or is that, that's not Brazil, this part of South America, and then Brazil down here to the south. All around Africa, same thing, along the edges, right? Australia, same thing. You know, up here in the Arctic, we have quite some thick packages up there as well. The one exception, you know, the Mediterranean Sea, this is actually tectonically active. Okay, and then Central Asia, kind of heading over towards Central Asia at least, you have some pretty thick basins there as well. It's a little bit different. Over here, the Brahmaputra Delta, this is next to India and just a part of Asia, right? This, these are the Himalaya right up here. Okay, the Brahmaputra Delta is really thick. This is an active margin though. In other words, India is colliding with Asia, creating the Himalaya. Okay, which, you know, the tallest mountain range in the world. So it's tectonically active. It's a very, you know, unstable environment, yet we still get a thick pile of sediments. And that's just because the sheer amount of sediment coming off of the Himalaya by the Ganges River and other rivers that ultimately come into the Bay of Bengal here. Just the sheer amount of sediment and makes it so that you still end up with a big pile, even though some of that stuff is being recycled, right, in this active margin here. But, you know, regardless, almost the thickest packages of sediment throughout the world are being deposited by deltas on these continental margins. That was really the main reason I wanted to bring that in here. So, you know, we also looked at the river system. I already mentioned you got point bars on the inside of these meander bends. Okay, that's important. That's where your sedimentation and your deposits are going to occur. On the outside of your meander bends, you got your cut bank. Okay, these are just basic features of a, what we call a fluvial system. Fluvial is the fancy geologic term for a river. Okay, let's just stick with river. But we have a river that's coming through here, a channel, right, where the water flows. And on the inside of a meander bend, you get your point bar. And on the outside, you get your cut bank. And that's the area where you have erosion. This is the area where you have deposition. And so if you're going to go try to collect sand and gravel, you go find your point bars. You go to the inside of meander bends, and you start shoveling it out. If you're building a house, here's another interesting thing. If you like, you know, the idea of building a house on a river, which a lot of people do, right? Beautiful areas. You also can think about, well, if you know something about the geology of a river and how it evolves, where would you want to put your house? Let's say that all of this land on both sides of this river was for sale and you could buy any of it and put your house wherever you wanted. Where would you put it? It's kind of a side note, but it is important. So if you think about it, on the outside of your meander bend here, that's where erosion's occurring. So if you put your house here, or let's put it on this side, this is also the outside of a meander bend, right? So there's erosion that's happening there. If I put my house here, okay, what's going to happen over time is this river is going to continue eroding away at my cut bank. Okay, so in other words, my yard, my river-facing yard, is just going to get smaller and smaller over time. And eventually, if it erodes enough, my house could fall in the river. On the other hand, if I put my house on a point bar, hey, this is a depositional environment. It's not an erosive environment. It's a depositional environment. So if anything, my yard is just going to get bigger over time, right? Because the river is depositing. It's continuing to deposit material there. So something to think about. You know, if you, I don't know if you're ever going to find yourself in that sort of situation, but yeah, it is important. Okay, this is kind of cool. So I don't know if anybody would recognize this. This is really close to home. It's the Ross Island Sand and Gravel Company in the Portland area. Okay, so let's turn on Google Maps. We're going to come out of Death Valley. There we go. Back out of Southern California into the Portland area because we are literally right there. Okay, and so Ross Island, many of you probably are familiar with this. So downtown Portland here, right? And then if you go just to the south of downtown, the Willamette upstream a little bit, see this river island here? It's huge, actually. It's very large. And it's actually got water on the inside of it, too. This is Ross Island, okay? This is Ross Island. You can see it's labeled there. And you have a lot of operations that has gone on over time on the inside primarily of Ross Island. And this is, Ross Island Sand and Gravel. They're literally quarrying sand and gravel out of Ross Island and using it for industrial and construction purposes. Okay, what we're talking about. There's a lot of reasons why you would want, and the general term for all this stuff is aggregate, okay? There's a lot of reasons why you might want that. And so that image that we were just looking at, it might either be from here or it might be from where they bring that stuff to, which is going to be, here's where the kind of the, yeah, this is where you'd enter it from McLaughlin Boulevard. This was kind of their thing here. And they have a bunch of operations that exist kind of right along the Willamette here as well. So they would be bringing material that they're mining or quarrying, either. Here, and you can see they're filling up these barges, and then they'll bring it back to the kind of mainland here, and then they can fill up their trucks and use it for all sorts of industrial purposes, right? That's where it's at. This is kind of what it looks like from the side. So you can see they just have these barges full of sand and gravel. I mean, it's what, we're talking about. In this case, it's a river island, so it's a little bit different than a point bank, but it is a point in the river where you have net deposition of sediments. Okay. So let's continue on. Interestingly, this is kind of fascinating to me. The Ross Island Sand and Gravel Company, is no longer, quarrying sand and gravel in this location. Okay, they still have significant operations going on, but they're no longer pulling sand and gravel out of the Willamette in this location to use for things. And this kind of gives a little bit of a timeline that shows where things are at. So, they began operation way back in 1926, so it was going on for a long time. And then you can see that in 2001, okay, mining stopped within the lagoon. So, by the year 2001, there was no longer active mining in that quarry. They stopped doing it. And why? Well, it's ultimately because, this is in an urban space, right? And it's affecting the environment in many ways, in many adverse ways. And at some point, different regulators decided, hey, we don't want this to occur here anymore. We need to try to get this back to some sort of a natural state. And so, they came up with a reclamation plan. And they've been working towards that since, really. Reclamation fill is ongoing, and I have a sense that it's going to continue for some time. But one of the things about sand and gravel is that it exists right in urban areas very commonly. Okay, and the reason for that, and this comes out of the reading as well, the reason for that is because sand and gravel is abundant. It's all over the place, right? It's pretty much in any river system, as we're seeing. You can see it's in a lot of different locations. It's not like it's very rare. It's kind of easy to find. And so the biggest issue with sand and gravel ends up being transportation. It's heavy. And so ultimately, transporting that material any more than about 10 kilometers or so from its source starts to become uneconomic. So people who are interested in, trying to find supply for the demand that exists, which there is demand, are generally going to be looking at locations that are close to the demand. And where is that? It's in urban areas. Well, a lot of it is, not exclusively, but a lot of it's in urban areas. So these sand and gravel quarries and mining locations are very commonly right next to or in urban areas. Okay, and that causes problems, right? Because there's an environmental impact. So there's a bit of a tension there, right? Between saying, hey, we want to put the quarry further outside of town, okay, now it's just going to cost more money to transport. But that's, you know, there's some environmental reasons that might make it worth it. And there's also some NIMBYism that starts going on, right? Not in my backyard mentality of saying, oh, well, you know, we don't want it in our backyard, but it's got to be somewhere, right? It's going to be in somebody's backyard. So that's also, it can be contentious either way. Okay, so let's continue on here. There's some other interesting examples out there, and this is one of them. This one is an aggregate quarry on the outskirts of Monterrey, Mexico. This is an image from the book that you can see, and you can see kind of where they're digging here on the image, right? They're just digging out, and this is just loose, unconsolidated sediment that's been pulled out of the mountain, right? And, you know, you got this city that exists right here. Okay, it's right on the edge of this city. And although these quarries are located perfectly, again, from an economic standpoint, they cause environmental issues. And in this case, one of the issues is particulate pollution, okay, which comes from the quarry. So what is that? That's airborne dust, ultimately. So, you know, in mining this stuff and mixing this stuff up, disturbing the ground, you're ultimately causing a lot of the finer grain material to go airborne. And you can even see some of the dust here on kind of the left side of the image that is created from, again, these sand and gravel quarries. So that's an issue, right? Most of these things have been closed since the 80s because of that pollution. It sort of reminds me back when we were talking about water resources and Owens Lake in California, right? The exposure of fine grain dust, ultimately, which is, you know, clay, silt-sized grains, and making it so that the air has access to those, you know, when you get winds coming through, they become airborne, and now people are breathing them, and that can be a health problem. So you see the same thing in aggregate mining. This is another really interesting picture to me. It's also from the book, but it's an aggregate quarry. And again, when I'm talking about aggregate, I'm talking about sand, gravel. You know, ultimately, it can either be crushed up, so you can take a cohesive rock and you can crush it into small pieces, right? Or you can just find something that's unconsolidated, so it's already small pieces, you know, and they can be rounded, they can be angular. There's a lot of different reasons to have them angular, rounded, depending on your application, but we just call all that material aggregate. So it's an aggregate quarry. In this case, we're looking at the south side of Chicago. This particular quarry is divided into two parts, and you can see there's this rib of rock that goes across. Well, there's actually one side there, one side here. There's another road that kind of seems to go across here, but within the quarry itself, you can see this road goes across, and then there's a tunnel kind of that connects the two. This is Interstate 80. I'm going right across this quarry, interestingly. Okay, and again, just outside the city, right? And very typical to find these types of mines existing right next to urban areas. And what are we using this stuff for? Well, there's all sorts of different applications. You know, aggregate, one of the things that people think about is in creating roads, and you can see all this broken up rock here. This would be the more angular form, right, where you take some rock and you crush it and you turn it into smaller pieces. It's a very typical use. One of the reasons why it's useful is because it has structural integrity, so it's not going to, you know, you can put things that are very heavy on them. I mean, they do need to settle. They do need to compact, for sure. But one reason why people like it is because it's very permeable. Okay, so you don't have to worry about water getting caught and sitting on top of it, right? It's going to permeate straight through. It'll infiltrate straight through and then go elsewhere. So that's a real utility. So just some general points here. Each home contains about 25 tons of aggregate. That's pretty amazing if you think about it, a ton being, again, a little over 2,000 pounds. And this would be a metric ton. The United States has over 10,000 aggregate mines. This is stuff that comes out of the reading. Incredible, right? Ultimately, we're trying to place them close to where the material is being used, so you end up with a lot, which is what we say here. Ancient deposits are cleaner than modern deposits. That's pretty fascinating. So in other words, if you go and find an old sandstone, right, that's millions of years old, versus, you know, sand, modern sand in a riverbed, in the point bar of a riverbed, that ancient sand is likely to be cleaner in a sense. And when we say cleaner, what does that mean? Well, it just means, it means that there's not, there isn't any mud. Okay, so you're sorting the grains. You have, like, if you go to the beach, right? You have sand grains on the beach that are all one size. It's very well sorted. That would be a really clean sand, right? Not all beaches are like this, but a lot of them are. On the other hand, if you go to a river, to a point bar, and it could be sandy there, but it could also be muddy, right? So if you got a bunch of mud in there, that's not as quote unquote clean. And that makes it not as useful, at least for some industrial and construction applications. If you go into an ancient deposit that's like 20 something years old, okay, a lot of times that sand, the way that it's being deposited means that it was more of a cleaner sand. Maybe it was a beach environment. Maybe it was a dune environment when it was deposited. At the moment, it could be a totally different environment. It's just like some tens of millions of years ago, it was a dune environment, and now it's exposed today, and you can mine that and then crush it up, and get a relatively clean aggregate out of it. Okay, here's another one that's a pretty interesting example. So we mentioned, and actually, ooh, I wonder if I can get there here. Okay, yeah, let's go ahead and click the link on this one. Oh, good. Yeah. Okay, so this is Glensada. And this was, where am I at here? I'm in Scotland, right? And so, generally this stuff is being used close to home, but in this case, this is kind of a little bit different here. We're actually, well, let's see where we're at in space first, just so you know. So, see, we're in Scotland, which is sort of the northern part of the United Kingdom, okay? And we have this quarry here. This is an aggregate quarry. And what's interesting is this one is nowhere near any significant population center. So this is kind of breaking my rule a little bit, right? You got, this is where you have a lot of the mining occurring. Okay. And then it's just brought down this road and then it's put onto barges where it's then shipped out to places that need it. And so there are some cases, right, where they'll spot a location for an aggregate mine, sand, gravel, crushed rock, whatnot, loaded onto barges. This one, has the benefit of being right next to this body of water. So it's relatively easy to kind of put onto these barges and send them away. And then they can be sent to places that are urban where they don't want these mines to exist right next to populated areas, right? And so that does also exist. And this is a popular mine. And it is shipped all over the place. Okay. Well, here I'm going to go back to the. All right. So actually, let's go back to that image for a second because there's some kind of cool images here. You can see this is actually the mine down here. This is where the material is being brought up to the surface. You can see all these terraces and such where they're just cutting away. I mean, it's open pit, they're just cutting away layers and layers of rock. Really beautiful area out there, the Glensada Quarry in Scotland. Okay. One of the other applications for aggregate that I wanted to mention, which is just kind of fascinating to me. So we already talked about drilling wells, right? And how mud is really important for drilling wells for a couple of reasons. Number one, if this is the drill bit, right? You got all these like teeth on the drill. This is actually what they kind of look like. There's usually three wheels like this, and then you have material mud that's circulating down through the center of this pipe, comes out, and then it goes back up through the annulus, which you can see is located here. It's between the pipe and the actual formation, the rock formation. And one of the things mud is doing is it's transporting the broken up rock from drilling, it's transporting that up to the surface so that you can keep going downward, right? It's pulling up what we call the cuttings. That's what these things are. These are called the cuttings. The other thing it's doing is it's maintaining pressure in the well, right? Because you actually have fluid that exists in the host rock in the formation over here, and that fluid is under pressure. And so if the pressure in the well bore here is low enough, that fluid will start flowing out of the formation and up the well bore, and that's where you can get real big problems, including blowouts, right? So you got to maintain pressure in the hole. And one way you do that is with that mud. Because the mud fills the entire hole. The mud has a weight to it, so it has a certain density, and so it exerts pressure actually on the formation, just like this big column of mud sitting in the hole. One thing though that happens too is if the mud weight is too high, it can exceed the strength of the rock in the surrounding the hole here. And that when it does that, it can actually create cracks in that rock, and it can actually start flowing into the formation. And that's kind of the idea behind fracking, which most people are familiar with, right? Or at least that term. That's creating fractures in the host formation here, because you increase the pressure, just you increase your mud weight ultimately to the point where the density is high enough that the amount of force that it's exerting way down here in the hole is high enough to actually break the host rock. Then the mud will start flowing in. Sometimes that happens by accident. Okay. Sometimes the engineers and the drillers just have mud weight in there that's just too high, and they didn't realize it was going to be too high. And so they start experiencing losses into the formation. The mud starts flowing into the formation. They're like, uh-oh, there's a problem. We need to plug that up. Okay. So now we get back to aggregate. So why would you use aggregate to do that? Well, one of the things that people will do is they will start mixing into their mud. They'll start mixing aggregate, so chunks of rock. Okay, and what that does is that as it starts flowing into these fractures, those chunks of rock get stuck because they're larger grain sizes, and so it starts plugging up those fractures. Okay, it starts plugging them up, and it'll potentially stop losses, losing mud into the fractures. So aggregate is used in addition to drilling mud. Sometimes when you have this problem situation where you're experiencing losses of mud going into the formation, okay, we're going to throw some chunks of rock in there, and it's going to get stuck in those fractures and keep flow from being able to happen. This is, when you have losses, it's generally described as lost circulation. You're losing your circulation fluid into the formation generally. And that can happen in fractured or highly permeable formations. It can happen because of induced fractures. That's fracking. Okay, that's what that's referring to. And what people will do is they'll start using what they call an LCM, which is a lost circulation material. You can see it's on this package here, lost circulation material, LCM material. So that's kind of redundant, lost circulation material. But one of the things that was really funny is, well, I thought it was kind of entertaining, is when I was working in the energy industry. At some point, one of my jobs was to read what are called scout reports. And these are reports that drilling operators will release, usually on at least a weekly basis. It just gives an update on where they are in terms of operating a well that they're drilling, right? And they'll say things like, okay, we're experiencing losses, we're losing our circulation, or we made it another 100 meters over the last day, over the last week, or whatever. They just sort of report general characteristics of what's going on while they're drilling. And one of the things that you see over and over again in these scout reports is problems while drilling. It's a tough thing to do. It's just an engineering challenge, especially when you get to really deep depths. And one of the things that will happen is they'll have to stop drilling because they're losing mud, right? They have lost circulation problems, and they can't keep drilling until you figure that out and you solve it. And so one of the things that they'll do is, I remember reading a scout report once, and they're like, yeah, we've been having lost circulation, and we're trying to deal with it. And so we ended up circulating in tiger bullets. And I was like, what the heck are they talking about? Tiger bullets. So then I looked it up, and this is hilarious. This is a bag of it, actually. It's tiger bullets. The one that I came across is called Tiger Bullets Extreme, which is even, it's like the next level, I guess. But ultimately, all it is aggregate. Okay, it's some, well, and it's a very finely engineered aggregate to be a specific size, angularity. Maybe there's some other cement-like materials in there too. But ultimately, it's something that you throw into your mud, you mix in with your mud that you're circulating in the well, in order for it to go out and plug up these fractures that are creating, so that you no longer lose mud into the formation, so that you can stop lost circulation. I just thought that was funny that the materials that people are making for this, they're giving really fancy like marketing names, like Tiger Bullets, to try to make them appealing to, drillers out there and be like, oh yeah, I'm gonna go buy some Tiger Bullets to stop my lost circulation. So it's a big business, and it's very important. So this is just an image to kind of give a sense of what's happening when we're talking about fracking, because that is something that's important to know about, understand, since it has been a big deal. So you have, you know, the well at the surface, you have your well bore, and oftentimes, you know, you may get to some depth and you have, these are layers of rock, right? Being shown here, like a darker, a lighter layer. You got your water table up here, which hopefully you're not interacting with, which is a problem, right? If you're interacting with the water table, with the aquifer, that's a problem. And that does happen in some cases, which is what in many cases gives fracking a bad name, right? Because you cannot be contaminating your usable aquifer. But there's a risk there. It has happened clearly in certain places. There's been documented cases of this, and you know, but it doesn't have to, right? You can do it in a way. You can do it in a way that's safe. I mean, you can minimize risk. But you know, that's the key: is you can minimize risk, right? You can do things as safely as possible. There will always be some risk, okay? If you're employing any of these technologies, there's always going to be some risk. But regardless, so you drill your well, you get down to your layer of interest, and in this case, it's a shale, it's a mudstone. Remember, I'm talking about mudstone. Mudstone does not have good permeability, right? Fluid does not flow through mudstone well. Yet, it can have quite a bit of porosity. You could get quite a bit of hydrocarbon in shale. So you get gas, for example, natural gas that exists in the pore space, but you can't get it to flow, right? Because those pore spaces are not interconnected well enough to allow it to. So what you do is, you know, you drill these wells and then you drill a horizontal. You bend the well, actually, and there's technology to do this, which is incredible. You bend the well and you go horizontal so that you're going right through that formation, just following it over space. And then in this part of the well here, you start circulating mud that's crazy heavy, right? And heavy enough so that by the time it gets over here to this location, it is... its pressure is high enough that it is breaking into the formation and creating cracks. Okay, that is literally fracking. It's creating cracks, and then what you would do potentially is you would then circulate in some sand, some gravel, because you create those cracks. As soon as you lower the pressure back to a normal pressure, those cracks are gonna dilate, they're gonna come back together. Okay, they're no longer gonna be permeable pathways. So you got, when they're dilated, when you create the cracks, you gotta then get some sand or gravel into those things to hold them open. Okay, and that's where some of that aggregate comes into play, or sand comes into play. So they'll circulate some of that sand down to try to get it to go into the cracks to keep some of them open, so that they can then produce or circulate out some of the hydrocarbon, what it is that they're looking for. Okay, so we're going to stop there. I feel like I went on for a while. Hopefully that was somewhat instructive in terms of learning something about how aggregate is used, why sand and gravel is important. Again, it is generally mined close to home, but there are environmental problems with that. It's also there's a huge market for it in terms of drilling wells. Hopefully that came across as well. And so, yeah, do the reading on this one and look for a quiz to help with understanding. And I'll talk to you again soon.